Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. I thought I'd tell you a little more before beginning with my very unusual and interesting guest about our fabulous conference and how well it went. We nearly filled at about 200 people, and we got a lot of feedback that this was just about as good a conference or better than the participants had ever been at before. It was really inspiring. One of the things we found out is that people are coming to the conference and getting so much inspiration that they feel as if it's their yearly refill, their yearly inspiration, their yearly therapy, in a sense. For me, it was also inspiring, and for Ginger, who managed the entire affair. It began with me giving, I think, one of the best speeches I've ever given, one of the best presentations, talking about what real neuroscience is, how it relates to what we know about human beings and empathy, and how medications always disrupt the frontal lobes, our highest evolutionary flowering, and always make us less empathic. Even if we can't sense what's happening because of medication spellbinding, the odds are any drug is going to make us less empathic. Then I was followed by Jerry Porter, who's a marvelous psychologist who got the audience warmed up and did a few simple exercises. It was the only time we did sort of experiential stuff. Very light and very good, and people really, really felt it got them more involved in the conference. Then we went to tough stuff, and I showed some film clips of tardive dyskinesia patients, people whose lives were wrecked, including small children, by antipsychotic drugs, which left them with abnormal movements of all kinds of bizarre, painful at times, very stigmatizing appearance. Little kids who couldn't even hold still on a couch. We then went on to have our breakout sessions, and they were just filled with all kinds of stuff, from, you know, personal growth stuff to stuff about electroshock and how bad it is, to a psychologist who's working with psychiatrists, helping them actually be more empathic with their patients. We had an interesting afternoon on helping the elderly and the demented without resort to psychiatric drugs. That was very interesting and heartwarming. We began Saturday morning with a session similar to last year, where people talked about their losses related to antidepressants and other drugs. We had Matthew Downing, who lost her preteen daughter to SSRI suicide, and Kim Crespi, whose husband was murderous toward her and killed two daughters and spending the rest of his life in jail. Just really, really tough stuff. And then we had a really great session from Australia, where my friend Martin Whiteley is managing as a parliamentarian from Australia to make Western Australia the only place in the world where ADHD and drugging kids is dramatically declining as a result of his efforts. And also Kevin Miller, the marvelous filmmaker of Generation X. Then we had some more great breakouts. And then we have one of the highlights of Joanne Cacciatore, a woman who lost her daughter to stillbirth and who went through profound mourning and has become one of the world's experts in helping people with issues of loss and mourning, especially sudden, unexpected, traumatic loss. She had people crying and she had people feeling empowered. And that evening, Bert Caron, a marvelous psychologist, and I had a two-hour conversation. It ended up going on for an extra hour with people just sitting around Bert talking to him. Bert had a bad injury in an automobile accident 3 or 4 years ago, and this was the first time that this great gentleman again spoke in public, and he was just marvelous and inspiring. And people came up to me, a highly trained professional, very experienced therapist came up to me and said she couldn't wait to get back to her practice because she had learned from listening to Bert and I how better to treat people with really severe problems like hallucinations and delusions. And we had a great Saturday too with Charles Whitfield and Peter Westdijk from Switzerland, and Yolanda Lucier, psychiatrist from Australia. I mean, what a great group of people. And then we did something new. My friend Jacques McLaren, he did a presentation critical of Thomas Szasz, of the lack of empathy and connectivity and caring in the work of psychiatrist Thomas Szasz. And we're going to be more and more on occasion addressing critically other people who are associated with the reform movement if we feel that they really need to be examined more closely. Well, we just got inspired by this conference, and we're going to be holding another one next year, April 26th, 7th, and 8th, in the same place, because it's such a lovely hotel in Syracuse. It's got a great atrium and ponds with fish and bridges and streams, and people love it. But it only is going to hold about 208, and we were just about filled. And so this is a year you might want to sign up in advance, because I think we might end up closing out the conference before its time has come. But it was a great conference. We're looking forward to another one. I'm going to be giving a lot of talks in other places throughout the next year or so. And I really hope to be talking to just innumerable folks around the country. And by the way, my new book that's going to come out July 27th, this year, not long from now, you can now purchase it online with a really good reduced fee on Breggin.com, BREGGIN.com. You'll find the book on the list of books on the right-hand side of the page with a picture. And the book is about psychiatric drug withdrawal, and that's what it's called, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, a guidebook for prescribers, therapists, patients and their families. It's oriented around involving everyone in the process. And one of the goals is to really see prescribers not as gods whose wishes must be enforced through medication compliance, but seeing prescribers as part of a team who need a lot of help and input, and seeing patients, families, and therapists as having more influence and impact. And half the book is about what you need to know about psych meds to have more of an understanding and more of an impact. And the second half is about psychiatric drug withdrawal from a team collaborative approach. The book's already up on Amazon.com, although it won't be available to the end of August. But from us and us alone at Breggin.com, you can get it at a nice reduction by signing up in advance. The copies will, however, not come until July. Well, that's a longer talk in the beginning than I usually give, but I had a lot to share with you. And now I want to share with you my guest, Chris Stankovich. Chris is from Columbus, Ohio. He's got a PhD, and his training crosses over between clinical psychology and counseling psychology. A good combination. Most or many of the folks that really understand empathy and caring come from the counseling end of education. Chris comes from both sides of that, at times, a breach between counseling and clinical psych. Maybe we'll get to talk about this. Chris said he heard about me many, many years ago and has used my books in his courses. He is very much involved in issues surrounding mental resiliency or mental toughness. He is focused on sports psychology, but often as an entree, really, or an entree and to a window to the wider issues of folks in general and how to help them. So, Chris, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bragg, and it's a true honor to join you today. And as you noted there at the outset, I have been referencing your work for many, many years, and I think it's proved to be invaluable, both in my practice as well as my duties as a college professor. So I want to thank you for having me on today.
Thank you, Chris, and call me Peter. Call me Peter.
I certainly will. Thanks, Peter.
Okay. That's the style of our show.
Okay.
And kind of the style of my life. So this is all about not kowtowing to authority. So you heard my introduction. Where would you like to pick up from there?
Boy, I don't know. So many good places. You know, the word that continued to resonate during your introduction was empathy, and I think it is such a truth when working with people and trying to help people find the strength within themselves to go above and beyond and do great things. And I know it's been invaluable for me to use empathy in my practice, especially when working with young athletes, as you talked about. A big part of my work is to help families and especially kids involved in sports use that experience to not only become better student athletes, but more importantly, to go on and use those athletic transferable skills in all areas of their life. And so in order to sell that message, I think empathy is a great tool in getting there.
Well, you know, I think it's universal, and we're finding that it's like a code word or even a green light or a beacon for people to come to our conferences and to just call me and get in touch, because it's bringing up a common theme that is very, very meaningful to people. Had you thought much about empathy in the past, or is it something you're thinking about more recently?
Oh, I think I always have, but I think it's become more amplified these days. You know, it's nice to get back to just the humanness of it, the connection between people. And I don't want that to sound corny or anything, because I think in contrast to the paradigm that exists today, where so many people, when distressed with the things that they experience in life, they so quickly want to turn to a solution or a quote-unquote answer that they find through a prescription. And it's a tough battle, as you know, and I certainly have experienced it in my professional life when you are trying to encourage people to find the mental toughness and resiliency and coping skills to get through their problems, while at the same time discouraging them from going the direction of a perceived quick fix, which I think we all know sounds good in theory, but really doesn't exist in most cases.
Chris, tell us how young athletes come to see you. How does that happen? And give us a sense of what you're doing with them and what you're learning and teaching.
Well, I think it actually started many years ago, back when I was in graduate school at Ohio State University. My doctoral dissertation was on the sport retirement transition of elite-level athletes. And why that may be important to note is that during that time, back in the early to mid-90s, we recognized that many college student athletes were lost when they hit that sport retirement transition. And I did an entire body of research around that phase in their life, and it prompted me to really dig deeper and to better understand what goes on earlier for kids. And as we all know, we're all touched by youth sports in some way, whether it's our own kids, our nieces, nephews, our neighbors. It just was such a wonderful medium to work with kids and to empower kids and to use all of those skills in sports to help them better themselves, because you know, the reality is very few of them are going to go on to compete in college athletics, and even fewer to play professionally. But I started to notice that so many kids were compartmentalizing those skills, and they either took them for granted or they falsely assumed that all of their peers also had these athletic transferable skills. And so it was a pleasant and surprising discovery for me, and I think it's served as the medium for the work that I do with kids. So it's really not so much about helping them become better athletes, although if that happens, that's a great thing. But more importantly, I want them to take all of the lessons that they're learning and make themselves better people through that.
So let's say, how old is it typically that kids come to you, youngsters come to you?
You know, I generally don't see kids much earlier than 11, 12, 13 years old. And probably most of the kids that I do see are high school age, some junior high school.
And how does it come about that they find out about you? And what do they say when they walk in to see you? What are they looking for?
Well, that's a good question. I think some may have just heard of me from simply being around a long time. I think others have been to the website, drstankovich.com. And others, I think, parents, you know, oftentimes I'll get that call initially from a parent who says, you know, my son or daughter is really struggling with a sport. We see the anxiety. She's a great practice player, but then we get into games and, you know, she struggles with her confidence. And what's interesting, and I'm guessing you'll appreciate this, they come into me, to my office for those reasons. But very quickly, we start to peel back the onion. And, you know, most of the time, the following sessions really steer away from sports, and we start to get into educational skill building. You know, how do you set goals? How do you improve your focus? How do you become more resilient to stress, adversity, frustration, failure? And so we're really doing life skills building and a little bit of sports on the side.
Do you at all get into what's going on between parent and child in the way of either positive or negative interactions and end up doing a kind of family therapy, or do you focus just exclusively on the positives?
Oh, no, I absolutely look at those dynamics. And, you know, one of the concerns, and you and I spoke about this off the air, you know, one of the concerns that I've seen in recent years, and this is becoming increasingly more challenging for me as a therapist to work around, would be the number of parents who seem to be enabling their kids. And that's certainly not trying to cast judgment on all parents out there, but I've seen more and more in recent years that rather than engage in teaching their kids skills that really can help them cope with the stress that they experience and losing and frustration, you know, more and more people seem to kind of enable behaviors, make excuses, provide reasons for why things are happening, rather than just address the issue head on and learn some skills to adapt and help overcome those problems. So absolutely, I have the parents involved very closely throughout the therapeutic process.
Now, part of what you're describing is that the kids are coming to you with a kind of performance anxiety. It sounds like they're doing much better in practice than in the game. And I'll bet that is running right over into that so common problem of test anxiety that kids have. Do you find that?
Well, you just hit the nail on the head, and I'm glad you brought that point up. And what I find fascinating when watching some of these kids compete in sports, I'll actually see from my own eyes how confident and how collected they are, you know, during those pressure situations in a youth or interscholastic sports event. And then I come to learn later that they struggle with test anxiety, or they have great difficulty getting in front of their peers in a classroom and delivering a speech. And, you know, that's very ironic because, in my opinion, they already possess the skill to be successful in those scenarios, but they haven't learned to parlay that skill. And so, you know, that's a real point of excitement for me when I do work with a youngster and I'm able to help him or her see that you may already have the ability to do that, you just don't know it. And so, you know, I provide some scaffolding through our sessions that allows them to reach those same levels of success in the classroom as they do in their sport.
Well, I think we're very much on the same page, and especially with young people, it's so important to be empowering them with what you say to them, what you teach them. I'm thinking of just the opposite of this, of a young man who came to see me and still in high school, and one of the last things his last psychiatrist said to him was, "You need to accept you're mentally ill." And this is a child psychiatrist. This isn't some country bumpkin telling a teenager, he's got to accept he's mentally ill. And I think you and I are coming from such a different viewpoint than that. And it's so important for listeners to hear that, you know, in every arena that you approach people to help them, so important to be helping them fulfill their strengths and not view themselves in some deficient way.
Well, I think you bring up a fascinating point. I mean, with the nebulous term of mental illness, you know, it's very interesting when you compare it to a physical ailment. If an athlete has a torn ACL, it's not an indefinite injury. We understand the prognosis for recovery. We also fully accept that if that athlete takes care of him or herself, in all likelihood, they'll be able to compete again. In years from now, we won't probably talk about the ACL anymore. However, you know, in contrasting that to mental disorders or mental illness, I think there's such an ignorance out there, and it's very frustrating for me because once someone does get a label attached to them, it's like an indefinite label that just never goes away, and it often becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, which creates even one more level that we have to kind of fight through in order to build that therapeutic relationship. So I find it very interesting, and a lot of my clients over the years have also come back to tell me, you know, horror stories about when it was later disclosed by them that either they or one of their kids sought mental health counseling and had a diagnosis afforded to them, and, you know, some of the stigmas and battles they had to fight through, and it's just incredibly sad to hear those stories.
Can you give a description of maybe one or two of the youngsters that you've helped without, you know, giving away anything confidential? Or would you like to think about it and do it a little later after the break?
Oh, I'm happy to talk about all of them, you know, as long as I'm maintaining their confidentiality, that's fine. You know, I will say one interesting type of client I've seen in recent years, and this may be something a little bit different to talk about on your program. You know, as I'm sure many of your listeners are aware, oftentimes when a student athlete or an athlete of any age experiences an injury, it's not uncommon, depending on the severity of the injury, to also have some type of a pain medication prescribed. And what I have seen, and this has been very eye-opening and scary and sad, I've had a number of student athletes in just the last few years be prescribed an opiate-based pain medication, and at the end of the cycle, a couple of these individuals, when they were unable to continue to get another prescription written for them, actually turned to street drugs, heroin. And we've had to work very diligently to help these individuals overcome that. And why I note this is, you know, it was quite surprising when it first happened. You know, I did not see it coming. And then I, all of a sudden, within a few months' period of time, had a couple of student athletes who, to the outside world, were, you know, achieving student athletes, got good grades, came from good families. But because of some mismanagement in the aftercare of their injury, their body was screaming for the opiate-based drugs, and they actually turned to heroin. So I think that has been a more contemporary type of issue I've seen with student athletes.
Now, how does that come about? Because in general, it's said, and my experience is, that if you're treated with opiates for pain, that by and large, if it's done properly, people may have some withdrawal, but they certainly don't become addicted. What's the botching by the professionals that leads to this?
You know, that's very difficult for me to understand myself. You know, I think we would both agree when it's done properly and responsibly, we shouldn't have these problems. And I'm not so sure, you know, if in all of these cases that was true. I'm not sure if maybe the prescriptions went on a little bit longer than they should have. I'm not sure if these physicians may have been easily coaxed to go a little bit longer with their prescription against their better interest. And it could also be a byproduct of, you know, the surge in heroin use across the country in recent years.
Yeah.
I know in Central Ohio we've had a number of counties around here that have really had big problems with the surge in heroin use. So, you know, I'm sure there's a sociological variable that's mediating that as well.
Now, one of the things I'm seeing a lot of is the addition of psychiatric drugs or non-narcotic painkillers, which in many ways are more disruptive to the mental processes than the opiates. So I'm wondering if you're seeing that, these kids getting loaded up on non-narcotic painkillers and on psychiatric drugs, and that's causing them even more trouble.
Well, I absolutely have seen that. And I think
by the way, I'm thinking of Lyrica. I was just having a little trouble getting that one out of the corner of my brain. But Lyrica is one of those drugs I'm seeing this happen with, and that's given for pain, and it's just a mind-bending, mind-suppressing agent, very similar to a psychiatric drug.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and I think the challenge is that we've got, you know, an entire cohort of young people today that have grown up in a world that commonly uses medications to fix problems, and you know, that's a challenge, and it's especially a challenge for someone like myself who really pushes these kids to, you know, dive into their own inner strengths and powers, and you know, to write out goals, to track their goals, to reinforce and reward their efforts toward those goals. You know, I'm coming from that side of the fence. And yet they're going back home to a world where, who knows, mom and dad might be on something for their depression or anxiety. The kid himself might have been on something for his ADHD since he was a youngster. You know, I'm really going through a number of different layers to just get to the human relation. And I've definitely noticed a change in that in just the last 10 years alone.
A change in how much the kids are being drugged.
A change in how much they're being drugged, as well as the paradigm where they expect that a person like me or you or any other counselor listening to the program today, it's almost like they look at us as having a ceiling that we hit, and that in order to really overcome, you know, the restlessness or the anxiety or the depression, that answer comes in the form of a pill bottle, not another person sitting across from them in a therapy relationship.
Yeah, we're seeing both go on, which on the one hand, there is this pushing of the drugs. But on the other hand, for the first time, I'm seeing, and I imagine you are, a lot more skepticism about the drugs. I'm seeing a definite movement now among people of both professional and non-professional backgrounds in terms of mental health, really seeing that drugs aren't the answer, that drugs are overused. When I talk to audiences in general, I'm finding them extremely responsive to the non-drug message. They all have horror stories about friends, family, children, and often elders who have been injured by psychiatric medication. Are you seeing also that trend, Chris?
You know, I think I may be, actually. And when I spoke to you earlier and then listening to you now, you know, I think about some of the people that I talked to and have talked to in the last year or two. And I think, and at risk of sounding patronizing to you, you know, I think a lot of your work is finally getting into the homes that maybe didn't reach before. I think some of the mainstream media, you know, certainly they've done a better job in highlighting some of these terrible stories related to various drugs and medications. So, you know, my hope, obviously, is that we become a better and more well-informed consumer. And, you know, it's tough. It's a tough message to sell. I've always encouraged people just to take a look at what science says and not necessarily what the commercials on TV are telling you, that are often very different than what reality is.
We'll be going to break in a minute. This is, of course, Peter Breggin, the conscience, maybe your conscience of psychiatry. I'm talking to Chris Stankovich. He's in private practice in Columbus, Ohio. He has a very interesting website called Sport Success 360. It's a multimedia approach to answering questions, lending help in regard to sports psychology, and of course in regard to the broader issues we're discussing. Sport, that's singular, Sport Success 360. Chris, when we come back, perhaps you could tell us a story or two of success or favorite outcomes. And in the meanwhile, let's go to break.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and my guest is Chris Stankovich from Columbus, Ohio. That's S-T-A-N-K-O-V-I-C-H. Did I get that right, sir?
You certainly did.
It's an accomplishment when I spell something right, as my dear engineer will tell you, with whom I am IMing as we talk. can you tell us a little bit about just some of your successes and some of the good stuff that happens and what you attribute it to?
Well, you know, you mentioned that before we went to the break to maybe think of a success story, and you know, the one that first popped up in my mind. I don't know that this is the best story ever, but it was one that was quite touching to me many years ago, and I still think back upon it today very fondly. I was working with a student athlete about 10, 11 years ago who had a speech impediment. He was a stutterer, and he had a lot of difficulty speaking, and I'll never forget, he was a golfer, and he and I worked closely together, and of course, I mean, we were working on some performance enhancement techniques to help him with focus and concentration and to handle his anxiety better. And through that, it became evident to me that he was doing just as I had hoped, and he began using these skills in all facets of his life. And I'll never forget, he won a golf tournament over the weekend, and he was so excited to tell me about it that he called the office on a Sunday evening. Of course, I wasn't there, and he left a voicemail message that was probably about 3 minutes long, and not one time did he stutter, and he spoke with such joy and confidence, and it was just a very special moment. It had very little, if anything, to do with golf, but it was just quite touching to see that he felt so good and so comfortable and confident in that moment that he could just speak freely, and I'll never forget that.
What did you do to help him get there?
I don't know that I can take any credit for that. I just supported him, and I believed in him, and I knew that he also believed in himself. And I think that for many years he was looking to find confidence in some aspect of his life. And, you know, I can only imagine how difficult it would be as you are introduced and meet people to have this difficulty. And, you know, he shared with me how awful it was for him to introduce himself, especially in situations where he was nervous. And so, you know, again, it goes back, I think, to the theme of your program. You know, I displayed empathy toward that and really tried to understand what it must be like. And we just really developed a very strong therapeutic bond. But, you know, he did the heavy lifting. I think I was really just on the sideline supporting him. I think I give him all the credit for that.
I remember working with a youngster once who had a very abusive father and, in fact, had literally left him behind and was living in a new family with a much more loving stepfather. And she had developed a stutter while living with her dad. And on one occasion, when she was really stuttering during a session, I just encouraged her to express her dammed up anger at her father. And she was finally, with huge effort, broke through the anxiety and was able to say, "I'm angry at you, I'm angry at you, I'm angry at you," without a stutter. And that was the beginning of her eventually becoming entirely stutter-free. It just brings that to my mind. There are so many ways to go about helping people, you know, with the same problem.
Absolutely.
There's so many ways to help people with the same problem. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, as I was kind of going through my mental catalog of some of my highlights, you know, it's really the everyday victories that I enjoy. You know, a lot of people that work in my field tend to want to get on the podium, so to speak, with the athletes that they work with. And it's quite understandable. I mean, it's a glamorous gig to be mentioned at the national or world level or to be associated with a pro or Olympic-level athlete. Certainly, the times it's happened to me, it's been very enjoyable, and it's a special moment indeed. But I have to tell you, it's the daily, everyday kids and families that I really get a kick out of and greatly appreciate and enjoy, just seeing them overcome what would be considered very relatively minor things to the average person out there, but to me they're very special, and I am very lucky that I'm able to work with so many good people. And those little conquests that we help a youngster at 12, 14, 15 years old, my hope is that he or she takes that and pursues bigger and better things in life and looks back upon those victories that he or she might have had as a teenager in sports.
You know, sports is so interesting in how much they mean to us as we grow up. I mean, I still sit back and watch a football game on television and find myself moving my body with the jig and the jogs and the ducking and the hurdling and just sort of twitching my body. My wife, Ginger, laughs at me as I'm running like I was still running, you know, like when I ran, you know, as a running back in high school, or I watched the trackman. I, you know, we talked about it. I ran the 100-yard dash. I watched the trackman, and I'm, you know, I'm just right there striding and reaching with them. And I still think back on the successes and the frustrations as some of the most vivid experiences of my life. So I can, and of course, I've had such a rich life since then. But I can imagine what it must be like for people who don't move, first of all, who have huge success compared to my very mixed experiences, and who then move on to a life that looks so bleak afterward. It must just be a tremendous thing to be able to help them find themselves.
Well, and I believe in our previous conversation that those experiences have really served you well with your mental toughness and resiliency, because I know that I just get a small dose of, infighting or arguments when I do lectures. You know, certainly there are some folks out there that feel very emphatic about the medications that they've been on and why they're helping and working. And, you know, sometimes I'll introduce just some objective empirical evidence that might fly in the face of what they thought. And I know in those examples, it can get quite heated. And I can only imagine you've built an entire career on speaking the truth, which obviously flies in the face of what many don't understand or want to know. So I have to believe some of your previous sport experiences have really served you well.
Well, I think so. I think that I was thinking even more about what you and I talked about. I think that the being an athlete who was only 5'4", when I running, I was 135 pounds, playing football, about a chunky 140, very chunky at 5'4". And I remember just that sense that no one was going to dominate me, that I would not be dominated, I would not be intimidated. in fact, there's a story that one of my friends, I didn't tell you about this, told in the book called The Conscience of Psychiatry, which is, you can get on my website, The Conscience of Psychiatry, which is basically stories about me from mostly the media and from other people's books and comments on me, with some material in between about the history of my reform work. And an old friend of mine from high school wrote about told me he was going to write about watching me tackle Jimmy Brown. Now, Jimmy Brown was the greatest, I think, halfback, running back of all time. He was from Manhasset High. I was from Widmere High. We played in the same league. And I said to my friend, I don't think I ever tackled Jimmy Brown in that game. And then he wrote this little piece to honoring mostly my reform work, but my determination. And what he described was Jimmy Brown dragging three or four of us festooned to him, including me, across the goal line, but that I never gave up as he dragged me across the goal line.
That's a great story.
I remember in that game trying to tackle Jimmy Brown or maybe the other halfback, who was very, very good, and being just thrown aside like I was a mild disruption in his track and field event. So it was football. But I do think that sports, and what came with sports also, were the boys who wanted to pick a fight with the smaller me, or younger at times me, or the me who was president of the class or Jewish, and the boys who wanted to pick a fight with me. And my determination from early on, God knows from where, that I would not be dominated and intimidated. And I think that has played a huge role in my later life, and especially in my becoming gentle. I think that you become gentle to the degree that you're confident in yourself. And I think it played a big role in my becoming more gentle and empathic as I grew out of being an angry young man into being a more caring adult. So, wow, that's a lot. That's a lot for me.
Well, I'd like to add, though, you know, I think it's interesting to me. I think in 2012, we have so many parents that get caught up in youth and interscholastic sports. Should my kid specialize in one sport? Should my kid play that sport year-round? And they just go, go, go. And sometimes this comes at the cost of talking about the very same types of things that you just discussed. I think it behooves families to sit down and to process the experiences. Sure, it's fun to look at the scoreboard and be a winner and win awards and so on. But it doesn't take that much more effort, a few minutes here and there at dinner, talking about what have you learned, what are some of these skills, how can you apply these skills in other aspects of your life. And I think it is such an empowering endeavor, especially for young kids. And, you know, I do hope that some of your listeners will think about how that applies to them, and maybe tonight at dinner have a slightly different conversation than one around just how many hits or home runs you had last night.
Yeah, I wish that someone had said to me when I was going through all of that what I've said to some of the kids in my practice, which is, you know, you're so powerful, you're so competent, you don't have to worry about this domination issue anymore. Mm-hmm. You just don't have to worry about it. You can just be yourself and play your hardest and do your best. But then on the other hand, I presume that somebody like Michael Jordan and Jimmy Brown remained preoccupied with domination to the very end. And I suppose that made them partially the great athletes they were, but maybe not the great husbands or fathers. Maybe they had to learn to be different in that regard. What do you think about that? That's an interesting big issue.
Well, it is. You know, I think you look at the drive to be the best, or, you know, in some of the cases that I've worked with, that perfectionistic mindset of, you know, only being a champion is the only way to go, and anything less than that is unsettling or unacceptable. And, you know, I think we need to give ourselves a little more wiggle room than that. We don't always win. And, you know, when I work with young kids, the big thing that I'm pushing for them is effort. You know, I tell them when they cross the white lines to play their sport, there's never an excuse to be unprepared. There's never an excuse to have a bad attitude. You know, so I try to empower them to think about what do they need to do pregame to feel good, to feel positive, to feel like they can compete today. And, you know, once you get into the games, of course, you can't control for your competition or how big or fast or strong they are. But, you know, when you leave the game at the end of the day, you want to know that you at least gave it your all. And I know this is cliche, but it's so important and so invaluable. And I think that's a big message for kids because, again, you take that in every area of life.
I'm with you 100%. It is something maybe more controversial. You know, we've now seen in the NFL this issue of bounties, where one of the coaches was putting a bounty on injuring other players. Do you find in your experience that really top athletes often develop a kind of reflexive violence that they have difficulty controlling when they're dealing with friends and family and loved ones?
I think that can be true, but I would probably frame that within a sports-specific discussion. In my experience, I have had more of those situations occur when dealing with athletes from more violent sports, like football or boxing or mixed martial arts. I don't see that type of problem from a golfer, for example, or a volleyball player, or even a baseball player. So I think it really depends on the sport. But that can be a tough thing. That can be a really tough thing because, let's face it, that aggression and violence that they use in sport to help them become successful doesn't really work outside of sport. I actually just wrote a blog today, and I used the example that, a hockey player checking someone into the boards in a hockey game is a good thing, but if you're at the workplace and you're going over to the copy machine and someone chucks you, they're probably going to get fired if not sued. So, you know, the context of these behaviors really plays into it.
Now, on your website, you mentioned things like what makes peak performance. And another issue you mention is what holds us back. So talk a bit about what holds people back from peak performances and what makes for peak performances.
Well, I'm glad you asked that. And actually, I'd like to speak to that in the using the term choking, because I think that's one that most all of us have heard at some point or another. And it's interesting, you know, my layman's definition of choking is when you know what to do and how to do it, yet you can't get it done in a real situation. In other words, you can make 80 or 90% of your free throws in an empty gym, but then you get into a game and, you know, you're barely lucky to make 50%. In those situations, the problem isn't skill acquisition, it's being able to keep your confidence high and your anxiety low. But interestingly, when you look at why athletes choke, and really you can parlay this into any discussion of people, human behavior, inevitably it starts with fear and self-doubt. And when you break down fear, most of the fear that athletes experience, and I would argue most of the fear that we experience just as everyday people, is irrational fear. It's not the fear of being in harm's way where we're going to be physically injured. It's the fear that we have of failure. What are people going to think? Are they going to talk about us? Are we going to lose our spot on the team? Is somebody going to write a nasty blog about us? But the amazing thing to me is that irrational fear manifests in the body in the exact same way as real fear. So whether you have a bear chasing you down the street or you're nervous about your coach taking you out of the game, you're going to have those tense, tight muscles, the butterflies in the stomach, the rapid heart rate, and then when all that's going on, your focus turns away from the only thing that's important, the next play, and you start to look inward and wonder what the heck is going on here, and then you use all kinds of negative self-talk, inevitably you fail, and then you go right back to the top of that model, more fear, more anxiety, and so on. So, you know, there's a takeaway for your listeners today is really examine your irrational fear. And when I work with kids, I ask them, what's the worst thing that can happen today? Your parents that brought you in here today are going to love you unconditionally. Your true friends are going to love you unconditionally. The world's going to go on tomorrow, whether you strike out or not. And, you know, I try to normalize it. And it's quite amazing how quickly things can turn around when we have those discussions.
Yeah, I think you really can turn things around. One of the things when I'm dealing with people who are having anxiety attacks, which is in a way what choking is, because often it's not a specific fear that they'll be pulled out of the game. It may be something that that isn't quite so specific as that, and that would make it more like anxiety, is to notice that you're starting to do helpless talk to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You're starting to say, I'm going to flub, I'm no darn good, oh my God, I can't handle this, everybody's watching me, and that you can actually learn what your helpless, self-defeating talk is at the moments when you choke or go into an anxiety attack, which I think are very, very similar events. I think it's really interesting to, again, to see coming from such different directions, helping people, how much we end up with very common observations on human beings, on how to help them, how to grow. Do you want to say more about mental toughness? I know you're concerned about the parents enabling kids not to be tough anymore, which I think is a really important issue.
Yeah, you know, I think that mental toughness, resiliency, you know, if you really distill down the variables of successful, happy, productive people, you know, I would argue that it is resiliency that makes a difference. You know, we cannot ward against stress and failure and losing in life. I mean, these things just happen. So it really makes more sense, in my opinion, to develop the resiliency that we need. You know, there's just no way we can navigate through life without trouble or problems. And so, therefore, it makes all that much more sense to develop coping skills, cognitive skills to help with our thinking. Certainly, there are a number of behavioral techniques that can help us stay calm and collected in those pressure situations. And the beautiful thing today is so much of this information is out there. I mean, someone can jump on the Internet and within a short time really find some good information and start to apply it. But I still think we have a lot of work to do. You know, I think there are still stigmas, especially in the sports world. You know, when you start talking about mental toughness, a lot of people still erroneously assume that that means somebody's got a psychological disorder of some kind. And I really think that that's not true. I mean, certainly there are some athletes that have disorders that may qualify from the DSM, but many more really could benefit from just learning these skills, I believe.
And I think it's universal. I'd like to see therapists and psychiatrists develop more mental toughness in facing up to the abusive practices of biological psychiatry, diagnosing, drugging, shocking people. So, and I think that mental toughness really is an important part of what we do, not just caring about our patients and helping them, but ultimately speaking truth about the abuses we see in this broad arena of mental health. But you do take your lumps for it, and you have to have a certain conviction that you want to speak the truth.
I absolutely agree with everything you just said, and it is a difficult message, especially in this world today that we live in, that people are literally bombarded with all of the reasons why they need to go to their physician to get put on something for whatever it is they're experiencing. And so it is. It's a tough message, and I think you hit it. You really have to have the conviction to sell that message. And I try to do my part. I certainly know that you do yours, and again, I applaud you for all of the work that you've done that's helped the rest of us sell that message even more effectively.
Thank you. We're talking with Chris Stankovich from Columbus, Ohio. He's got a fascinating website, Sport Success 360. And on Sport Success 360, you'll find videos, you'll find script, you'll find suggestions and directions. And Chris, is there another way also for people to get in touch with you? You can give phone number, email, website, anything you're comfortable with.
Yeah, sure. I appreciate that. Well, my website is drstankovich.com, and there's a lot of different products that people can purchase, as well as a lot of free downloads. If you're a parent, a student athlete, or a coach, I think there's a lot of good information there for you. I also have sportsuccess360.com, and that is our sport education system designed to help with the overall culture of a school athletic department or a youth sport league, so people can certainly check that out. And if anyone's on Twitter, I'm at Dr. Stankovich is my handle there.
Thank you very much, Chris. In concluding, you know, life is about courage. Life is about mental toughness, mental resiliency, and ultimately about having so much of that strength that you can be kind, gentle, loving, and supportive of other human beings. And the two go together. Life is tough. There are dangers and risks and oppressive forces sometimes in our own families, always in the circle around us somewhere, because human beings struggle with life, and they often do it in a way not advantageous to all of us. Thank you, Chris Stankovich.
Thank you very much today for having me.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.